Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my alpha titan co-host, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Hi, Charlie.
Hannah, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me in my entire life. I'm an alpha titan. No one, my wife, my kids, nobody has ever referred to me as an alpha titan. So fair enough, I will be an alpha titan, as long as I don't have to fight one. Let's see. Hannah, life's okay right now. It's cold. They swear. The weather people swear this is the last of winter. No more winter after what we had today, which was ridiculous. I've got MLB Extra Innings on TV because it's free right now. You don't need a subscription, so the Rays and Marlins are on. Shout out to Joe, our executive producer. He's a Rays fan. And time flies. We were just talking about it off air. My baby from last year, remember we had a COVID baby? He's one on Easter Sunday. He's one.
Oh, unbelievable. I haven't seen him since he was 2 weeks old through a window.
Yeah, you saw him one time very briefly through a window.
Yes. So it's I might be knocking on your window on Sunday and just being like, hey, is anybody home? Oh, you're not even going to be here, are you?
Well, you can do that and say hi to the cat. I'm leaving the cat.
All right.
The agenda for today. Let's talk about the biggest one. The big. It's one of that Warner Brothers thing, you know, the Warner Brothers. They're co-releasing in theaters, in IMAX, and on HBO Max for 28 days. We're going to talk about Godzilla vs. Kong, and then we're going to move into Oscar bait. We're going to talk about an international film. We're going to talk about a documentary, because the Oscars aren't here yet. But before you know it, they're going to be here, and then you're going to be blindsided. Oh, I meant to watch all the documentaries. Well, we're with you. We're catching up. With you, we are Oscar completists. We will complete it with you. But first, the obligatory. Yes, we have to talk about the biggest film of the week, Godzilla vs. Kong. I remember 2014, they rebooted Godzilla. That was good. That was a good movie. I remember really liking that movie. Then there was Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and the bad guy was actually Vera Farmiga. Not the biggest fan of that movie. And then there was Kong, like back in 2005, but that wasn't the real reboot. Then there was Kong Skull Island, with Brie Larson and Samuel Jackson hanging out in, like, Vietnam. And now they're like, okay, let's bring them together. Apparently this is a thing. Let's bring them together. And how are they going to bring them together? Alexander Skarsgård! They're going to use that. I guess if there's a biggest star in the film, it's Alexander Skarsgård, my favorite pirate actor. Skarsgård. I'm looking at Hannah right now. She's not laughing at my awesome joke.
Well, I'm like, you know, you did understand that the Alpha Titans is what the Godzilla and Kong are referred to as in this movie.
I understand. And somehow you have to get the two together. And to get the two together, you need human interference, an evil corporation skullduggery led by Demian Bashir. And you need to say goodbye to Pensacola, and you need to say goodbye to Hong Kong, and hello to Hollow Earth. You'll learn what Hollow Earth is. But yeah, you have to get through the humans to get to the Alpha monsters. Hannah, once we got to Kong versus Godzilla beating the ever-loving snot out of each other, did it do it for you? Was it worth it?
No, because for me, it's actually the humans interacting and feeling some sort of stakes involving the human characters that have always made these movies more tolerable for me. I'm not a monster movie fan. So I did not see Godzilla King of the Monsters. I did see Skull Island, Kong Skull Island back in 2017. I liked that one. But I think I liked it because of the humans that were in it and the sympathy that you felt between them and Kong. And so to me, first of all, I don't think the big fight scenes between these two legendary monsters even came into play until pretty deep into this movie. And I was already so bored out of my Skull Island that I could not even figure out whether I wanted to watch the rest of it or not. And so maybe if I had seen it on a big screen, this is definitely one of those movies where I know a bunch of people who saw it either like in a drive-in last night or were going to see it in a theater or saw it on a very large home screen TV. I do not have that. And therefore, to me, this was not a movie that translates to be watching on HBO Max on a regular screen. It just, it fails entirely on that score. Whereas maybe I would have liked it a smidge more if I'd seen it in a big theater.
I guarantee you the experience would have been more effective in IMAX. It would have punched harder. However, it would have still had the same problems that I saw on my big screen television. The humans are garbage. The story is garbage. Now, the humans at Kong Skull Island were okay. They almost had a second mm-hmm. dimension. They were pretty good. Mm-hmm. There's a story going on there. But here, Alexander Skarsgård, he's a scientist, and he needs to get Kong to Hollow Earth. I don't really know why. Like his Skull Island is like being affected by climate change. It rains a lot, and he's in the Truman Show. It's very strange. He's accompanied by Rebecca Hall. She's the Kong scientist, and she's got a little ward, a little short round, who is the Kong interpreter. She teaches Kong sign language. How cute is that? And then there's Isa Gonzalez. We just saw her in I Care a Lot, where Rosamund Pike just won a Golden Globe but didn't get nominated for an Oscar for it. Good. She's along as one of the bad guys. Millie Bobby Brown. She has no interaction with any of those people I just mentioned. She's in an alternate track. She's Kyle Chandler's daughter, if you remember him from the previous film. And she listens to the podcast of Brian Tyree Henry. We know him from Atlanta. He's a podcast guy. He knows the real story. This corporation's up to no good. And our boy, Ricky Baker from The Hunt from the Wilder People. Julian Dennison is his name, but I can only know him as Ricky Baker. They all get together in the second human enclave and funnel around the earth from Florida to Hong Kong doing nothing. They're the people that just get to discover the truth, which means nothing. Because we're here to watch Kong and Godzilla, lizard versus ape, beat each other up, throw each other into skyscrapers, and really kill like a million people. You don't see any like people die, but they got to kill like 2 million people. Adam Wingard is the director. He's a horror director. He directed a very good movie in 2011 called You're Next. Very good movie. He directed a not good movie in 2016, the sequel remake of Blair Witch. Garbage. He's now made the worst installment in this Godzilla King Kong universe. This is by far the worst. I assume we're in the minority. I'm looking at film Twitter here, and it's people are mixed. Like, oh, it's so good. Kong and Godzilla. Like, people care. Well, they really care about who wins.
Yeah, there are people generally who just acknowledge that there's no story here, or that any story that there is preposterous. And so if anyone had trouble following your take on what the plot was, just know that that's kind of what you get in watching this movie, is there really is no way to track this plot. And it doesn't make much sense. And it's really absurd. And I think that's the problem, is I felt no investment in the monsters or the humans. The only part I thought, you know, was kind of cute was just the deaf girl who is able to communicate with Kong, and that he's managed to learn sign language without anyone else on the island realizing that he knows it. And so that was really the only thing for me that even came close to any kind of feels at all in this movie. I've seen people who actually just say, look, just it's fun. It's monster movie. Just embrace it for what it is. And for somebody like me, who just generally is not a monster verse type of person, I'm not going to go out of my way to watch any of them. The fact that I did like Skull Island, to me, then that made this one even more of a disappointment, because I was kind of expecting it to be somewhat similar in bridging that human monster divide a little better.
I'm fine with monster movies. I'm okay to set up the two best known monsters of all time, monster e monster. I'm fine with that. It's not fun. Whoever says this is fun, escapist, turn your brain off. It's not. It's not fun. It's a chore. It's boring. There's no Kyle Chandler. who's Bill.
No, and that was my biggest gripe.
There's no Lance Reddick.
If you're going to have Kyle Chandler in a movie, why have him in a movie for only a minute doing absolutely nothing? That was just heartbreaking to me because, you know, I'm a huge Kyle Chandler fan and he's in there at the beginning and then you really don't see him again until close to the end. And he has really no reason to be there. And so very distressing. If you're going to put Kyle Chandler in a movie, give us more Kyle.
None of these humans have any reason for being anywhere near these monsters, near Kong, near Godzilla. It's a terrible, terrible script. Yes, it's really good looking. It does look like
yes.
The monsters are really hurting each other. Hong Kong at the end kind of looks a little squishy, but it's gorgeous. When they get to Hollow Earth and Kong's flinging around, anti-gravity, upside down, whatever, great. It's fine looking. And it would have looked even better and more impressive on IMAX, I have no doubt. It doesn't change the fact that this is a garbage movie.
Yeah, it's a Godzilla-sized meh for me as well.
All right, let's move on to our vegetables. The first one is nominated for Best International Film, which was a surprise to film critics, regional film critics, because we were not given an opportunity to see this, to look at it, to vote on it, to nominate it ourselves. It was only given to Oscar nominators, Oscar voters, which is why this feels like it came out of left field, feels like it came out of nowhere. And actually, it came out of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Quo Vadis Aida. I know. Our entire listening audience already speaks Latin. I know this. But for the one person who snuck in here who does not know Latin, I'm going to go ahead and translate that. It means, where are you going, Aida? Where are you going? I can't believe they haven't made this Srebrenica movie already. I figured they would have. This happened in 1995. And I was in high school. I wasn't paying attention to Bosnian wars in 1995. But I was in college when I read. I was in an undergraduate class. The professor assigned a book, The Srebrenica Book, and it blew my mind. I could not believe the genocide that happened in July 1995 to over 8,000 Muslim men and boys in the Bosnian village of Srebrenica, conducted by the Serbs under the command of General Ratko Mladic. That's not a spoiler. That is history. He was prosecuted in The Hague. It's a thing. So director Jasmila Cibanić said, she's a Bosnian director. This is her fifth feature film. And she said, I can't believe no one's make this movie. Fine. I'm a Bosnian director. I'm going to make the Srebrenica movie. And she conducted all the interviews with all the survivors, the women who were there, the United Nations members, the Dutch. And to get us into the story, a very wrenching story, she created a character. Aida is not real. She's fictional. There really was no Aida. She's a composite, a conglomeration of other people. Aida Selmanagic is an interpreter. She works for the United Nations. She translates English and whatever they're speaking, Serbian, Slavo-Croat, I'm not sure. And she sees what's coming. She's no fool. Mladic rolls into town. Townspeople roll into the UN compound. The UN compound says, we got nothing for you. Mladic says, hey, here's some buses. I will take you to safety. Trust me. She doesn't trust him. So she's trying. It becomes a personal savior story. She wants to save her husband. She wants to save her two sons. Hannah, this gut-wrenching tale, very suspenseful, very edge of your seat, yet foreign international film. A, did it work for you? B, is it in the top five international films of the year?
I think it is. It's a very powerful watch. It's a distressing watch on many levels. I did not really want to watch it because while you were in high school, I was actually working at CNN during the 90s when Yugoslavia was being torn apart and there were all these wars going on. And I remember just the bitter rivalries going on between, you know, when you tried to, you had a map with Bosnia and another with Herzegovina, and everyone would call and say you've drawn the lines for the geography in the wrong places. And so we knew that if every side called to complain, that we were doing all right, because it was that divisive and bitter. And I remembered there is a really, really heart-wrenching scene where women are going through an empty, big empty room looking at bones that have been dug up from a mass grave to try and identify loved ones. And I remember that real footage. I remember getting that footage in after these mass graves were discovered and the bones were being looked at. Like, I remember that that really was being shown to the international media. And I remember Ratko Mladic and you know, seeing him in snippets of footage. And so I think it is really important. This is a forgotten atrocity on, you know, I think. And so while it's very hard to watch, it is, I think, a worthy watch. And yeah, I haven't seen all of the foreign films yet in the top five for the Oscars, but I do think this one definitely belongs in there and maybe could win. I don't know if it can win because I'm just not sure enough people really will have sat through it, and other movies just have a little more buzz around them. But I think the buzz is kind of growing quietly and slowly for this one. Because it is such a powerful story, and I think the timing, you know, it serves as this cautionary tale that we just somehow keep forgetting to really take heed of, that the stuff just gradually just kind of comes up on you, and you can't trust necessarily that. I mean, the biggest problem in this film and with what was happening was that the UN kept issuing these ultimatums, but they had no teeth. And so you just hope that that we can sort of get back to a point where you can really trust that if the UN, if the world comes together to try and stop some atrocity, that people will take heed. But they certainly did not back in the mid-90s with this story. And so you just kind of need to keep showing it to people and hope that eventually it takes hold.
There are a few people that come across really bad in this film, other than the Serbs, other than Ratko Mladic. It's the Dutch. The Dutch, yeah. Led by, the real guys are named, Colonel Kermans, Major Fracken. They're wearing shorts and t-shirts underneath, you know, as their uniforms. Urine, the United Nations bureaucracy, which just kind of abandons them, comes off really bad. NATO comes off really bad. But yeah, sorry, the Netherlands. You guys come off real bad in this film. The buzz for this category, Best International Film, is actually around the Danish film, Another Round, whose mm-hmm. director, Thomas Vinterberg, was nominated for Best Director. So naturally, his film feels like it's leading the pack. However, that film is just garbage compared to this one. Here's an interesting fact, one that I didn't take away from. I didn't know I was watching because there's no way you could have known. The actress who plays Aida, Jasna Juricic, in real life is married to the actor who plays Mladic, Boris Izakovic. They're married.
Wow, I would have watched it.
The Bosnian interpreter is married to the Serb general, the most notorious.
I would have watched it so differently. I would have watched it so differently if I had known that. But this really is Ida's film, you know, and it's about women. In many ways, it really, and the director said this, I think in her statement, that the film is about a woman caught in a male war. And, you know, it's really about the love and courage and resilience of these women. And also about, you know, what happens when we fail to react on time when things are unraveling. So I did like that it's you know, that she says it's a film about a woman caught in a male war. And you really do get that sense that this is just kind of Godzilla versus Kong in a war mode. And if you had more women in charge, maybe of the UN at the time, maybe there would have been a little more leadership in play.
This is Godzilla versus the women and children of Srebrenica. Like, there is no battle. There's no contest. You know, she's caught between two worlds, civilians, her home. She knows some of the Serbian soldiers sent there to commit genocide. She taught them in school. They're her neighbors. I think, you know, the director created her because she gives us insider access. Mm-hmm. She knows more than everybody else. So she gets us in there with the refugees and the displaced. So yeah, big thumbs up for Quo Vadis Aida. Good luck finding it. good luck watching it. But just know, if you're an Oscar completist, you gots to, because every now and then when there's a big upset at the Oscars, it happens in this category.
Yeah. And, you know, from everything I've heard from the people who've seen this one versus the people who've seen another round, a bunch of them have said this is the stronger movie. And so I just hope it gets seen by enough of the Oscar voters so that it doesn't get lost. Because I do think that if you're really weighing what this award is supposed to go for, you know, hopefully Quo Vadis Saeeda will make the cut.
All right, let's stay on the Oscars, but let's move from international film to best documentary. Now, this documentary has been on Netflix for a while, for a long time. I didn't know it was there, though, so I didn't see it, and I never, you know, we never screened it, never came out in theaters naturally, so I only learned it was on there this week. So let's talk about My Octopus Teacher, another film that I hadn't heard of until it was really nominated, because it wasn't given to regional critics to discuss, nominate, and vote on. My Octopus Teacher follows Craig Foster. Craig Foster is South African, and he is a documentary filmmaker. He got burnt out making a documentary. He needed to get away from the editing booth. He just sat in his house and he snorkeled. He lives in the Cape of South Africa, so he can walk out his back porch to the beach and snorkel down into, I guess, what is a famous kelp forest down there near Cape Town. And while he was doing that, seeing all the flora and all the, I don't think it's fauna. What is it? I don't know. Swimmers.
Wildlife.
All the wildlife down
underwater
there.
Wildlife.
Craig takes a shining to an octopus, a regular common octopus. He just starts watching her. She appears very intelligent, and he goes back every day for 1 year to watch this octopus swim, eat, defend herself against another thing I didn't know existed, which is pajama sharks. And really, you know, she's surrounded by predators, but she's also a predator herself. Next, you know, if there's reincarnation, Hannah, I do not want to come back there. I don't want to live there. Every day is a fight for survival, a fight for food, just a pain in the butt. But Craig just takes a shining to her, and she, conversely, takes a shining to him. At first, she's scared. What is this thing? What is this camera? But she reaches out her little tentacles. You know, they touch fingers, they touch hands, and they play together a little bit. And she expects his visits. He goes every day. And this makes My Octopus Teacher one of the most fascinating documentaries I have seen all year. And if we had seen this earlier, it would have been in my top five documentaries. I latched onto this. I loved it.
Well, a friend of mine had actually talked about it to me, several weeks ago. And so when I saw that you had watched it, I was like, all right, I'll check it out too. Because my friend had given it 8 thumbs up, which I thought was really cute.
That's funny.
So I was like, all right, I got to see what this is. But it took me some time. You really have to be willing to take the time to get into the rhythm. This is very much a nature doc. And so if you like those National Geographic nature docs and the wild animal kingdom kind of things, this takes that really to another level, because it really is fascinating, but I had to stay with it to get to the point where I cared a little bit about what was going on, the relationship between Craig Foster and this young octopus, and just the fragility and wonder of nature is just shown throughout this film. And visually, it's stunning. It is absolutely stunning. And it's just fascinating to kind of learn about an octopus in a way I certainly had never given it a second thought. But when you just think, it makes you realize too that if what it takes to just sort of build a relationship, it could have almost been any animal. It makes you feel like Finding Nemo, you know? It's like, I'm going to go back and find the same fish, which is probably would be more difficult. At least the octopus kind of had her place, where her den, where she'd be hanging out most of the time, which is why he was able to repeatedly find her. But that she got used to, almost like any other animal that just gets used to their human showing up. You saw that bond develop and grow, and it just is like nothing you've ever really quite seen before. but it is the pacing and the rhythm of the guy's voice. it took a while. And I think a lot of people, my fear is that they turn it off after like 10, 15 minutes, but you really have to give it a little longer. You got to get into like past that first half hour to really, pardon the pun, dive in to what the story is really about. And so, yeah, I don't know where this ranks on my documentaries for the Oscar picks just yet, but I'm glad I saw it. And so it's definitely a different breed from any of the other Oscar-nominated documentaries in recent memory.
Even though he is there every day, watching, interacting with the octopus, Craig has sworn a somewhat policy of non-interference, even though his very presence there is interfering the natural order of nature. He says if the octopus's friend, she gets in trouble, he's not going to help. You know, she gets in trouble frequently with sharks, and he could very easily go down there and scare the sharks off. They're not dangerous to humans, but he lets them have at her. He's like, hey, this is nature. If she's going to survive, she has to defend herself. And some of the, you know, sometimes you're like, hey, man, just punch him in the nose. Get in there, brother.
Swat him away.
Because he gets very emotional. He's like, hey, she could have gotten hurt this time, or she lost an arm. And he cries. He, you know, he gets weepy. I'm like, well, that's your own fault, man. You could get in there. And then at the end, we learn what happens at the end of an octopus's mating life cycle. I had no idea that this is what happens. Sorry, octopuses. I know you evolved this way to continue your species, but that's just dumb. You need to evolve better. Longtime loyal friend of the program, Christian Hammerker. I remember him putting on this on one of his lists. He also appreciates this film very much. And if Christian likes a film, you do need to take note. He has very good quality taste in film. He brought up a point where no one's, you know, necessarily accusing the directors or whatever of malfeasance, but selective editing. But, you know, this was edited after the fact. We're just taking it at their word that this is sequential, that what he says is day 154 really is day 154, and that they didn't edit this to make it a bit more interesting than it really was. You know, they said, we're on the up and up. This is chronological. This is what happened. And, you know, but people that study film are like, well, we, you know, there could have been some trickery here. We don't know. There's really no identifying features here.
No, and that's true, because I read that he started filming in like 2010. And so I don't know how you can be filming for, you know, several years to do a 365-day sequential film. So there is some wonder there as to whether or not there was still some creative license taken in putting together a narrative that would work in a documentary. But the truth is that we see that in so many other documentaries too. So it's not that uncommon. It's the way every reality show is edited that people watch. If they watched it in real time, the way real things unfolded, they'd be turning it off after 10 minutes because it would just be so boring. So there is a bit of craftsmanship that goes on in the editing. There's a reason he burned out being in an edit bay for as long as he was, because you really are working on finding that particular shot that helps you tell the story. And so, I kind of cut him a little slack here, but I also wonder whether or not you can really buy into the fact that it was supposed to be sequential.
I can't imagine anybody turning this off after 10 minutes. I was enthralled like the first 30 seconds in. I enjoyed the pace of his voice, the pace of the story. I'm glad it wasn't fast. He took me on a journey, taught me something I didn't know. Hail to this movie, Hannah. Love it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, yeah, I think next week, too, maybe we'll start diving into some of the shorts that we've been watching, because those are some of my favorites. I like to call them the Oscar mini movies. They can be sometimes my cat is totally in the microphone right now. But so we'll try and figure that out for next week. And also, I just wanted to make a quick note that Concrete Cowboy is out on Netflix as well. So if you start watching My Octopus Teacher and decide, is there something else on Netflix that's more of a standard narrative film, then Concrete Cowboy with Idris Elba is actually an interesting choice, because you'll learn a heck of a lot that you probably never knew about Black cowboys in urban Philadelphia on the streets of Philly. So we'll talk more about that one next week as well, because maybe then you'll have a chance to see it. I saw it back in the day at the Middleburg Film Festival. So I kind of thought they had tried setting it up for some awards buzz, but then it kind of fell off the radar and I haven't really heard much else about it. So that's something for next week. Anything else, Charlie?
No, you have my blessing, and I understand if you don't watch any movies this week because you're watching baseball. Like, I get it. I'm watching it too. It's fresh. It's new. Full 162-game season. I get it. Let's watch some baseball.
We're celebrating Easter. We're wrapping up Passover, so we get it. Or if the weather's supposed to be beautiful, really, get outside.
Or if your kid is starting a Little League season and you're the assistant coach, I get it. Yeah. You might sprain
there
something.
There you go. Yeah. All right. So in that case, that's a wrap for this Easter weekend edition of the Cinema Clash. Thanks for listening. As always, if you have a question, comment, need to vent to Charlie, shoot us a tweet or visit us at thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, you know what to do. Wear the mask, watch your distance, wash those hands, and when it's your turn, which it should be very soon, please take the shot.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.